Good afternoon, everybody. I am delighted to welcome you to our celebration of Lost Delta Found and a celebration of the career of John W. Work III. I'm Bill Ivey. I'm the director of the Curb Center for Art Enterprise and Public Policy. We're an arts policy center at Fisk's sister institution, Vanderbilt University, a few blocks south of this campus. And we're delighted to be the sponsor of this event today with some wonderful co-sponsors, and I want to acknowledge them now. Dr. Jesse C. Smith and Janet Walsh, the John Hope Franklin and Aurelia E. Franklin Library here at Fisk. Ami and the Fisk Department of Music, Betsy Phillips and Sue Havlish of the Vanderbilt University Press, and Whitney Weeks, who's worked with us with Vanderbilt University's Office of Public Affairs. And I also want to especially thank Mike Curb, the Curb Center's founding sponsor, because Mike is also very involved in Fisk University and in the work of the Jubilee Singers. And there's nothing that Mike likes better than to have the institutions that he supports here in Nashville work together on projects. So I know he wanted to be here. He's out of town today, but I know this means a lot to Mike. This event started a few months ago with a call from our public affairs office saying, you know, the University Press had just published this book. Wouldn't it be nice to have some kind of an event, a reception, to recognize the editors and the project? Of course, the book is Lost Delta Found, Rediscovering the Fisk University Library of Congress, Coahoma County Study, 1941-1942, and this is edited by Robert Gordon and Bruce Nemiroff. Obviously, that book includes more than a single author. It includes John W. Work, Lewis Wade Jones, Samuel Adams, each of those three whose work is included in this volume went on to distinguished careers. And of course, hovering in the background is the work of Alan Lomax, who was part of the original team and was at that time with the Library of Congress Archive of Folk Song. That little idea for a reception kept getting bigger and bigger. Heather Lefkowitz, our program manager, thought, gee, maybe we should do something a little bigger than just a little reception. We knew of Mike Curb's interest in Fisk and Vanderbilt working together. We talked with the press. Heather and I both talked with Paul Kwame about the Jubilee Singers. And then we contacted John Work III's sons, Dr. John Work IV and Judge Frederick Work. And lo and behold, we ended up with a fairly big event in which both Dr. Work IV and Judge Work were able to travel in, Judge Work from Gary, Indiana, and Dr. Work from New York, to be with us here today. This book brings together three manuscripts. I am assuming that not everyone in the room has read the volume or is familiar with it, so I'm going to say just a few words about it. It brings together three manuscripts that have not been published before. The Mississippi Delta by Lewis Jones, an untitled manuscript about the music of Coahoma County by John Work, an interesting set, a fascinating set of musical transcriptions of the music from that area, also completed by Dr. Work, and then a study of the sociology of the community, Changing Negro Life in the Delta by Samuel Adams. And these were all Fisk-based scholars working together on this project. It was really a project that had its inception here on this campus, and what started as a study based on Natchez, Mississippi, was eventually expanded into a partnership between Fisk and the Library of Congress, which became this study that involved Jones, Adams, Work, and Lomax. The project was originally completed in 1941 and 1942, and if you look through the volume, you will find that that the bulk of the pages are devoted to the efforts of Dr. Work and of Samuel Adams. Now, initially, the participants in this study assumed that this was going to be issued as some kind of a single report, a final volume. But a whole range of circumstances intervened. There were career changes. Obviously, when you say a project began in 1941 and was completed in 1942, a little thing called the Second World War came along between those two, the beginning and the ending field trips. And there were a number of other factors. The burden of other work kept these elements separated. And some of the research ultimately, 50 years later, formed the basis for a part of Alan Lomax's book, The Land Where the Blues Began. But the other elements were somewhat scattered and did not see publication. And I will say it fascinates me to think what would have happened had these various circumstances not intervened and these four very distinctive scholars, each with a distinct point of view, been in a sense forced to come together and produce a final volume. We'll never know what that volume might have looked like, but from the elements that were in place, I think it would have been a wonderful study on its own. So one of the things we're doing today is really celebrating and acknowledging the publication of these important pieces of work by Fisk scholars that have been unpublished and in a sense unacknowledged for many years. And the second thing we're doing is focusing in on the career of John W. Work III. He's part of a distinguished Nashville family and a distinguished Fisk family. He was born right around the turn of the century, last century, in 1901. And he, of course, was a teacher here at Fisk. He chaired the Department of Music here. He was a musicologist, a folk song collector and scholar, but perhaps is best known as a composer of classical works, some gospel songs. And he directed for a time the Fisk Jubilee Singers. He retired only in 1966 and passed away just a year after his retirement. Had a very distinguished career. So we're going to be celebrating his career in two ways today. First, we'll hear some music, which I think is appropriate. And the order of music will be slightly different than what's in your program. We'll have all of the music at the beginning. So we'll hear from the Jubilee Singers and also from Jack Emerson and William House, our blues duo. But in addition to the music, we're going to have a panel discussion among a number of folks who know the Jubilee Singers, John W. Work's career, and this particular volume from different perspectives. We'll be bringing together Bruce Nemiroff and Robert Gordon, the two editors, and also family members, Dr. John Work IV and Judge Frederick Work, and also Professor Emeritus Matthew Kennedy, who perhaps from a professional perspective knew John Work better than anyone who could be with us today. So to begin, I'd like to introduce Paul T. Kwame, who is now the director of the Fisk Jubilee Singers. Paul grew up in Ghana, was educated here at Fisk and also at Western Michigan University, and is as true of so many who have had distinguished careers at this university, studied here, went away for a time, came back, and became part of the Fisk family. I'd like Paul to come forward and say a little bit about the Jubilee Singers and their heritage, and then bring them onto the stage. Please welcome Paul Kwame, director of the Fisk Jubilee Singers.
Good evening to all of you. This is a very exciting occasion for me personally. Having come from Ghana to attend school at Fisk, and knowing little about Fisk then, I discovered almost immediately that the Negro spiritual was and is a very strong cultural source of relationship between African Americans and Africans. And then for me to be a Jubilee singer even meant more to me. But then I began to read and hear about John Work III as we sang a lot of his songs. And I realized that this was a man who did so much to keep this music alive. I believe had it not been for him and a few others, we wouldn't have the Negro spiritual performed today. I regret so much that I did not get to meet him, so I envy Professor Matthew Kennedy, who studied under him. But I'm also thankful that Fisk University and many other institutions like Vanderbilt, Belmont University, continue to support us in many ways. And so this evening we'll have the Jubilee Singers present some of the arrangements of John Work. We'll have two selections. The first one is his arrangement of This Little Light of Mine. And then the second one is Live a Humble. Thank you.
steady he runs. Don't let him catch you with your work undone.
Live a humble life. Bells and bells and bells.
Such a man as God, he give up his son for to come and die. Give up his son for to come and die, just to save my soul from a burning fire.
Live a humble,
to judge a man come.
Live a humble, the bells and rung. Live a humble, the bells and rung.
Thank you, Paul. Thanks to the Jubilee singers. I realize I should have used the invocation that precedes almost every gathering these days, which is please turn off all cell phones. If there are any still on, please turn them off. I will mention that we will have a reception following our panel today, and also I think there are a limited number of books that are available. So should someone be inclined to purchase this excellent volume, there are some copies in the available in the back of this room. It's my pleasure now to say a few words about our second performing ensemble. When the team of sociologists and anthropologists, musicologists, folklorists moved into northwestern Mississippi in the summer of 1941, they were interested in not only the sacred music traditions, but also the secular, the blues, play party songs, and other forms of traditional expression. In addition, they were looking at the context of that music, where songs were performed and why they were performed. We're very fortunate today to have two contemporary practitioners of that Delta blues style, William House and Jack Pearson. Blues harmonica, William House, who also is a guitar player. I'm not sure exactly what instruments are going to be coming forward because each is versatile, but William House primarily plays harmonica as a vocalist, has played with and toured with all kinds of acts, Bobby Bradford Blues Band, has been involved in studio albums with Greg Allman, Jimmy Hall, and others. His partner, Jack Pearson, lead and slide guitar player with the Allman Brothers Band from 1997 to 1999. He's influenced by traditional blues players like Brownie McGee. He also is a mandolin player. And they tour, they work as, despite their distinguished careers as individuals, they've worked as a duo for a number of years, touring the festival circuit, working in schools. And there's a 1999 CD, which is appropriately titled William House and Jack Pearson. So we're very close. And it's now my pleasure to introduce William House and Jack Pearson.
Do another Muddy Waters song called Country Boy.
getting late on in the evening. I feel like blowing my horn. 'Cause I woke up this morning, y'all, and I found my little baby gone. Hey, getting in the evening. Oh, and I feel like blowing my horn. Woke up this morning, and I found my little baby gone. Brooke run to the ocean, Lord, you know the ocean run into the sea. If I don't find my baby, you're gonna bury me. I said the brook run to the ocean, and the ocean running on to the sea. Oh, if I don't find my baby, man, you know somebody's still gonna bury me. The people that tell me, oh, worried blues ain't bad, but it's the most miserable feeling I've ever had. There's some people tell me, well, red blues ain't bad. Hey, it's the worst old feeling.
Called Mr. Engineer. Bring my baby back.
Mr. Engineer, bring my baby back. Yeah, you know, I know that you took her down that lonesome track. I heard her leave this morning on that 5:15 train. Heard her leave this morning on that 5:15 train. I don't think I'm gonna see my little girl again.
Thank you, Mr. Engineer.
Thanks very much, William and Jack. William mentioned that the first two songs were Muddy Waters songs, and of course McKinley Morganfield, who became better known as Muddy Waters, was one of the artists discovered in those field trips, 1941 and 42. He really got his start there. Now it's my pleasure to bring forward our panelists who will talk about this volume and also about the career, the work of John W. Work III. First, please welcome I see one here. I need, well, there's, I'll wait because I don't see John Work the Fourth. May have stepped out for a moment. Oh, there he is. Please welcome John Work the Fourth. I think an emeritus economics professor. And Judge Frederick Work, who's now an attorney in private practice in Gary, Indiana, but was a judge for a time. Our editors, Robert Gordon, who's a filmmaker, the author of Can't Be Satisfied, The Life and Times of Muddy Waters, and a couple of books about Elvis Presley, and a book about Memphis music, and producer of many films, Robert. Bruce Nemiroff, who's at the toward the other end of the table, who is a record producer and author of The Story Behind the Song, 150 Songs That Chronicle the 20th Century, just a book that's about a year old. And also let's welcome Professor Emeritus Matthew Kennedy. He's emeritus here at Fisk. Became the accompanist for the Fisk Jubilee Singers back in 1940. And of course, he has a career as a concertizing classical pianist, recording artist, and arranger, Matthew Kennedy. Now, I'm going to start, ask the panelists a few questions. I realize I'm off to the side, which is a little bit awkward. But to get the conversation going, and then I think it'd be great if they would feel free to ask one another questions. Bruce, in your afterword in the Lost Delta Found, you talk about the unique character of Work's transcriptions, you know, and his analysis. In your view, what was special about what you had to work with? What separated him out from what other people were doing back at that time? And just if you would, grab the mic. We've got two mics for the five of you to share. So,
what I found interesting was in his transcriptions was he didn't correct things that were incorrect like so many others did. Some of those folks in North Carolina that were doing transcriptions in the 20s and John Lomax and Alan Lomax, they would do collect many versions of a song and then do a sort of a best of version that they would publish. Professor Work certainly didn't do that, but even when somebody was singing what a trained musician would say was a wrong note, he wouldn't correct it in his transcription. And in point of fact, in music like you just heard William and Jack do, there's a lot that's wrong by Bach and Handel's standards in there, but it's obviously not wrong for the music that it is. Professor Work recognized that and went to great pains to transcribe exactly what was sung, not what he thought, as in his words, not what I thought ought to be sung.
Uh-huh. I have a question for the Work brothers, for John the Fourth and his brother. When you're... No, it's not that kind of question. It's not about folklore or folk music. I'm just curious, given the breadth of your father's career, when he went off to work, what did you think he was going to do? Was he going to be a teacher? Was he going to be the director of the Jubilee Singers, a composer, a research scholar? What did it feel like as growing up with him? Either one of you, just what do you...
I think that both of us realized what he was doing. He made it very clear to us that he was interested in folklore, folk music. And on the trips that he took, not only to Mississippi, but trips that he took to Haiti and other places, he made it very clear to us that he was interested in the music of that time and the music of that era. And So we didn't confuse what he was doing.
Right. Despite the fact he had such a broad career, it came through to you that he was very interested in this vernacular stuff, and this was an important part of his work.
Yes.
John, do you feel is that the same for you?
Let me build on my brother's notion here a little bit. He's smarter than I am, but my father did not separate in his mind, I don't believe, being a teacher, being an author, being a composer, being an arranger of those things. He did not, in my judgment, do that. To him, this was one big thing that flowed from an interest in history. While he certainly had his first published composition at about age 16 or 17, Matthew Kennedy would know this better than I, but I believe it was called Mandy Lou, he majored in history at Fisk. That was his major, and he always had that interest. And so trying to identify historical strains of music was something that he was passionate about. We don't talk very much about the fact that the great Jimmy Lunsford, for example, with whom he played football here on the Fisk team, Jimmy Lunsford was one of the greatest ends ever. But he was also a great jazz musician. And Duke Ellington would come by the house from time to time. These were strains. My father had an extensive collection of jazz, even wrote for, I believe, the Harvard Encyclopedia on the definition of jazz. Is that right, Matthew? Would you remember that?
Gospel study, I believe it was.
Gospel study? Well, the reason I remember it being jazz is because I remember Fletcher Henderson being mentioned in it very prominently. Who was another person who had come by from time to time. Now, these I remember, Freddie and I were just little tykes when these were taking place. And so, if you look at it in that historical context, these things build one to the other, from the blues to the Negro spiritual to the jazz to his own compositions, many of which were serious, and then his later compositions, which were many of which were atonal. So he had a full view in his mind of what this was about. And the roots of it, in his judgment, were in Mississippi, in Alabama, in Haiti, in Africa. So that's how I see mm-hmm. that.
Robert.
Question for the work brothers. Was it?
Why don't you grab a mic?
Yeah. Was it unusual to be exploring the roots of the vernacular music? I mean, jazz was getting big, and he was in that scene. But to be going to be looking toward the southern rural areas, while at the same time having this classical background and a foot firmly in the jazz scene, were you aware of it being unusual?
Unusual?
To be looking at the blues roots, basically.
It didn't strike me as unusual. It may have been. I don't know about you, Freddie. What do you think?
Let me ask Professor Kennedy a question about this, because his perspective is different. He was a student and a colleague. From that point of view, working as an accompanist with the Fisk Jubilee Singers, and then in a sense coming along and becoming the director and working with John Work in that context, what's your sense of where his heart lie, where his primary interests were, how all of these things fitted together? Did it seem like one thing to you?
Yes, I think so. He loved music, and that included all the phases and genres of music. And as a student with him, I was in his counterpoint class, and we just looked at it from the authentic and classroom work of the great composers from the past. Mm-hmm. And you can see how in his compositions it's all-encompassing to a fine degree.
Even in his gospel arrangement with Dr. Work, when you met him and how long you studied with him, what your experience was?
Well, I looked upon him as my mentor, and it's quite interesting that before my wife, husband and wife, she was really a member of the extended family, and he had told her as an undergraduate that he wanted to see her come back to Fisk to be on the faculty. But when I proposed to my wife, the person she went to get approval and find out what he felt about me, she went to Professor Work. She had lost her father in an early age. She was just about 12 when her father was actually killed in an accident, train accident. But she felt that close to the Works. And he and Mrs. Work, well, first of all, I'm very pleased that he gave me a very fine recommendation. And they provided our rehearsal dinner. And of course, the wedding took place in Fisk Chapel. And we were close to the president, Dr. Charles S. Johnson at the time. And he and Mrs. Johnson insisted that the reception be held in the president's home. So we were off to an excellent beginning. We knew that an extended tour was coming up for the Jubilee Singers in September of 56. And we considered actually holding up on the wedding until after the tour had been completed. But Mrs. Johnson insisted that we go right ahead with the wedding because we really didn't know what the future would hold. And just that interval would not be too bad for me, for us to be separated. But it was quite a grueling tour, and Mr. Work's health had begun to decline. He had a heart condition. And when they returned to campus after that tour, where they gave concerts in 9 countries over a period of not quite 40 days, he was so exhausted that he was placed into the hospital. And he told me at that point that he wanted me to take over the Singers. And I was happy to do so because I thought that was just an emergency. But doctors told him that he needed to ease up on his schedule, he needed to give up the chairmanship of the department, and he needed to relinquish directorship of the Singers. So he more or less handpicked me to succeed him, and it became official when the administration went along with his wishes in 1957. He was, to my feeling, rather self-effacive, of quiet demeanor, but that was an inner strength there, and he knew what he wanted where music was concerned. When he told me he wanted me to take over the singers, I told him I just didn't feel that I was adequate to step into his shoes. But he said, well, the kind of background you've had, I feel you're the right person for the job at this time. So I'm glad that he persisted, because I ended up directing the singers for a period of 23 years, not consecutively, but over a total of 23 years I was the director. He was very productive. Simona Atkins quantized all of his works, and there were a total of 110 published works. And I don't think people realize how productive he was and prolific. But shortly, well, about 7 years after his passing, it was decided, and I believe Mrs. Work was the impetus in getting a memorial foundation started, the John W. Work III Memorial Foundation. And Frederick and John will remember, I'm looking at a reproduction of that program. You participated in the program?
Sure, I was trying to get them to change it to the fourth as opposed to the third.
Well, John has a very fine baritone voice. He sings quite well, and actually, I think his father wanted him to follow music as a career, but he ended up going into business and economics. But this was a wonderful occasion, and when we started this foundation, the John W. Work III Memorial Foundation, you sang two selections, Three Glimpses of Night by your father, and Every Mail Day, one of his arrangements. I was your accompanist. And my wife and I played his concert piece for two pianos. The principal speaker on that occasion was Marian Anderson. My wife had more or less a firsthand inroad there because she and Miss Anderson had been friends for a number of years. And it was a very successful getting this Memorial Foundation started. And I am so happy that I became a member of the foundation. I'm still a board member. But we decided, among the things that we wanted to do, was to perpetuate the memory of John W. Work III and to make certain that there would be scholarships available for students and musicians coming along, especially Afro-American musicians, as composers, performers, researchers. And this foundation is going along quite well, and we are so happy that some of us decided it would be a good idea to place the funds that we had in the hands of the Middle Tennessee Community Foundation. And this was a great idea because in perpetuity, the name and the memory of John W. Work will continue, and students will be able to receive scholarships through the Community Foundation.
Well, I think one of the great opportunities that the publication of this volume has given us is to
revisit John Work's contributions to music scholarship and again shine a light on his career. And I'm wondering if Robert and Bruce would talk a little bit about how this came together, because I may not have been entirely clear in my opening comments, but the book is really made up of manuscripts that were separated for years, and there's an element of detection involved in putting pieces together and bringing things back together, and I know each of you played a role in finding and reassembling different parts of it. So I don't know whether Bruce...
Yeah, I guess it starts with me, and it starts with another fellow who really would have loved to have been here tonight, but he's in ill health, Dr. Charles Wolfe of MTSU, a name probably known to some of you there. And he sends his best regards to everybody, and he's overjoyed. He wanted me to make a comment before I start on the detective work on this, to say that the Fisk Archives, Library and Archives, is a world-class resource. He published a volume of Dr. Thomas Talley's Negro Rhymes, Folk Rhymes, Wise and Otherwise. He found the music that accompanied the text from the original 1922 publication. And that's been reprinted. It's out now, out in paperback. He appreciates the library. Dr. Smith, I think, is still here, and the paragon of special collections librarians, Beth Howes. They're a treasured resource to a lot of people beyond the Fisk campus. So those are Dr. Charles Wolfe's words. What happened was Charles got me involved in this, and inadvertently in a 14-year job at the Center for Popular Music at MTSU by meeting Dr. Work's widow. And she told him that there were folk music recordings at the house, which was on the edge of the campus here at that time, that had not been donated to the Library of Congress, that he had kept close to them because they had special meaning for him. And got Charles's interest, and he nominated me for a research job to be funded by MTSU to go to the house and start digging around, seeing what was there. I found some very, very interesting things. A Holiness Church service from Pulaski, Tennessee, with the most astounding version of Amazing Grace, sung in the Mixolydian mode, call and response, very unusual. A whole bunch of things. Using those materials and some of his writings, we cut together a radio documentary which aired on